All right, everybody, here we go again for yet another Tech Doctor podcast. This is Robert the Tech Doctor, and I'm hopeful that Allison may be out there somewhere. Allison, are you there?
I am floating around here in space, yes.
Excellent. And how is it floating around in space?
It's marvelous. It's zero gravity is just beyond anything I could have imagined.
Well, I'm sort of glad that you happened to mention that you're floating around in space, because we're going to be talking a lot about space today. Did you do that on purpose?
I did, I have to admit.
You did.
Okay, that was awesome.
That was really, really excellent. Well, today on the podcast, we are very fortunate to get to discuss a topic that we have not delved into very much on this podcast. And I love it when we can step out and talk about something a bit different, something new. We have the good fortune of having with us a woman who's completing her undergraduate degree at Virginia Tech, and she will tell us all about what she's studying, but I'm not going to give that away except to say, Chelsea Cook, welcome to the Tech Doctor podcast. Thank you very much for taking some time to be with us. Tell us a bit about yourself and what you do and who you are, and let's go from there.
Thank you, Robert. This is a great honor for me to be here. So, Allison, how did you get up in space before me? This shouldn't happen.
Well, I'm in California, you know, so we're very enterprising over here.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you say that. I'll return to that later. So I am a senior at Virginia Tech, majoring in physics with minors in astronomy and mathematics. And astronomy has been something that has interested me for a long, long time. The physics and mathematics were kind of just segues and piling on top of it to get to the actual really cool stuff about the universe. And so I've done a lot of cool things at Tech to sort of facilitate that. But also, I've always been interested in just astronomy and space, and now everything's kind of, pardon the other pun, up in the air. I can't be diplomatic about this, so I'm not going to be. I really don't care what the government says. I want to go up into space one day and actually be an astronaut and work on some really cool science in space, because I feel like that's the only way to really do it and experience it. I mean, we've got all kinds of telescopes and observatories and really cool stuff that we're just sending out there, and humans are the next logical extension of that.
So Chelsea, when I grew up, I was very excited about the space program, but it was a really different era back then with the Apollo program and people going to the moon and things like that. And so in some ways, it's really exciting to me to hear you talk so enthusiastically about space and exploration. But what is the situation these days? You know, is it likely that we're going to have a space program with men and women actively exploring space again? What do you think about all that?
That's an awesome can of worms to open. My opinion is just one, of course. This is why I need to get out to California and be with a lot of those enterprising people. But anyway, realistically, it depends on the politics. And really, whoever controls the White House controls the money and controls the, at least the governmental space program. When the shuttle was nearly about to be retired in, well, it was retired in 2011, but when it was nearly about to be retired in 2009, 2010, when the Constellation program, that was the one that was supposed to have us go back to the moon, before that one was canceled, I was fortunate enough to be at NASA Langley, which is very close to my hometown of Newport News. So I was fortunate to go there, and I was talking to some of the people and some of the engineers there, and I said, look, you know, what's going to happen with you guys? Because the shuttle has sort of been what NASA's been doing in the space arena. And they said, well, we had this problem back in the 20s and 30s with aviation, with should the government completely control it or should private companies control it. And it turns out that it's going to be 50-50 of both. And so they were projecting that the space program would sort of be the same way, where you'd have all of the experience that the government had, but then you would have private companies, some of them operating the flights. So now you've got like SpaceX and Virgin Galactica and those kinds of things. I'm really hoping that that happens. I'm not so sure. I think the other problem with space exploration is simply the economics of it. You know, everyone's like, oh, well, with so many problems down here on Earth, why do we need space? And what they don't realize is that we've gotten a whole bunch of spin-offs from space. I mean, without the sort of push to invent something as simple as the transistor. Now, that happened a few years before, but something as simple as the transistor and the microcircuits, you know, we wouldn't have all of this awesome Apple technology and wireless things. And, I mean, even the CCDs that are in your digital cameras, they once started out, and they are primarily what telescopes use to capture all of the different optical wavelengths. So there's that, and then there's just the sort of jobs and innovation that come from a spacefaring economy. So I'm really hoping that people can see the big picture and we can get back up there and start doing some really awesome research.
I completely agree with you, and
good.
I sincerely hope we get back to space exploration. It was such an important part of the whole country.
Exactly. And I know that my I didn't mean to cut you off, but I remember my mom, she was born just before the space race kind of happened, so I'm not really sure what generation, how far you guys are apart, but you know, she remembers the moon landing and she remembers the sort of exciting time. But I think because she wasn't in a position to really understand it or really take in all of that, or frankly it might have been an interesting, I don't know, she can't really describe as well as I would like what it was like to be in that time. And it must have just been an awesome time to be in, and I'm really hoping that something will happen. Now granted, we can't have another space race just like that, because all of the political landscape has changed and history has changed, and you know, but just to capture that excitement and that wonder again for this country would be incredible.
Yeah, and it's such a way for people to unite around a common goal.
Right.
I was actually 13, I guess, when the moon landing happened, and I very clearly remember watching it on TV and waiting up most, if not all, the night for it to happen, and you know, just how exciting it was. And there was so much enthusiasm about what was going on. And in contrast to that, there were people like my grandfather, who was pretty convinced that it was just something that was staged, that it really didn't happen. And so,
interestingly enough, one of my grandfathers thinks the same thing. So when I go visit him, I have to be really careful.
Yeah. But regardless, everyone on Earth practically was engrossed in it, talking about it with whatever their opinion was. And it was a very exciting time. And it was also an amazing thing to think about, the technology that we went, you know, to the moon with.
Oh, I know.
Was so very primitive compared to what we have today.
Oh, I know. And that frustrates me again to short of a degree. I was part of the Blind Driver Challenge. They were still doing it the first year I was at Virginia Tech. And so I got into some of the interface discussions with a lot of the engineers. And it really showed me how just plain complicated actually driving is. And I realized that, you know, because I grew up in sort of a technology age, but also because I was surrounded and made myself surrounded by flight and airplanes and spacecraft of just everything, that, you know, flying is actually, in my opinion, a lot easier than driving a car would be. I mean, you have a lot of the technology up there already to aid you, and it's really just the interface that needs to be worked on. And that's not necessarily a project that I would want to do as a career, but as a little side venture, oh, that would be fun. Because there are actually a few blind pilots in, like, Europe and just sort of scattered all over the world who have done similar things. I think one of them in France, he even broke, like, a world record. But it's just really awesome. I mean, if you think about it logically, there's less stuff to hit. Yes, you're moving in three dimensions, but still, you use a lot of orientation and mobility skills that blind people just know about sort of by training and by necessity. You know, it's all compass directions and velocity vectors and things of that nature and sort of hitting a target for landing. And so I'm not saying that it's easy, but I'm definitely saying that it could completely be possible, and I don't understand why it's not.
Is that what you're talking about, Allison, when you say you're hovering in space? Are you flying around?
I've actually wanted to learn a little bit more about flying and getting, not necessarily getting a pilot's license, because that's very expensive and time-consuming, but it is something that has always interested me, so it's cool that you talked about that.
Yeah, it's really something to think about. I never thought much about it. So, Chelsea, take us back a little bit, because I know that I read in an article that you published in the Braille Monitor that this interest in space and astronomy and physics, I don't know about physics, but at least astronomy and space, has been a long term interest for you. I think you said starting around age 10. How did you become interested in these things at such a young age?
I guess I just remember, like, always being sort of fascinated and interested in it. There's a couple articles around the web from sort of that time that I've recounted where, you know, I remember my mom, by this time I was about like 5 or 6, and I remember she was waking me up in the middle of the night because the full moon was right outside my window. And I had a little bit of vision so I could sort of see that there was a light out there, and it was just really cool to think about. And then a couple years later, the Nickelodeon cartoon Jimmy Neutron came out. And I'm laughing fondly because it sounds sort of a corny, cutesy idea, but, you know, Jimmy was one of those characters where he was a boy genius and he thought that science kind of held all the answers, or most of the answers. But at the same time, he wasn't really liked or understood by the people around him for his intellect. And I could relate from a blindness standpoint, from a woman's standpoint, from a, you know, beginning to be a nerd standpoint. I could completely sort of relate to him. But the other premise of the story was that, you know, he didn't really care. I mean, sure, he had relationships and that kind of thing, but he would go off and do what he wanted to do with science. So it was just a very cute sort of movie and story, and just gave me confidence in the fact that, you know, in a little childhood way, well, if he could do it, maybe I could go and do something similar.
So it kind of sparked that interest for you. And one of the other things you mentioned was the Touch the Stars, I think the book was called.
Yeah, I was just about to talk about that. So those two things combined really did it, because Touch the Stars was a book, is a book, it's still around, by Noreen Grice. And it was really the first Braille astronomy book that I had seen. And so I was reading it, and I was looking at the tactile pictures, and I was reading about, there was a foreword by Kent Cullors, who unfortunately has disappeared off the face of the earth. But anyway, he's gone out to like find the aliens, I guess. But anyway, he wrote a foreword in that book, you know, saying, look, I'm the first blind radio astronomer, but this is something now that technology has allowed us to do. And so sort of just those two events combined really sealed it for me. And, you know, the spark was there in Jimmy Neutron, and then sort of the actual reality was there in the book that, hey, this could definitely happen for me.
So you were in elementary school, I guess, when you were beginning to get those early sparks. And how did you take that dream, that those ideas, and move forward into actually becoming a college student where you are now? How'd you get from the dream to making it more of a reality?
So one of the things that I did was in high school, you could apply for a magnet program or a special high school. And the one that I chose was called the Aviation Academy. And so you went there, and it was actually, they rented out the old airport terminal. And so you went there and you studied and you learned about a couple of different things. There were classes in sort of piloting for the older students who wanted to get their pilot's license. And then there were classes in like air traffic control, and there were college partnerships to do like aviation maintenance kind of things. And of course, simply by necessity and because people were freaked out at the time, I mostly did sort of the theoretical stuff. So you learned about the basics of flight and fluid dynamics. And the really cool thing was that in 10th grade, everyone was required to take physics. It was, and that's not usually done, I don't know if it's done out in California, but that's not usually done here until the 11th or 12th grades, when, you know, all of your sciences are kind of out of the way. But you needed physics early to start and to really understand some of the basic things that were happening in flight and aviation and how air moves over a wing and that kind of thing. So I was very lucky in that I had an extremely good physics teacher. He was good at what he did, but then he was also really good with describing things and presenting material in a way that I could understand. And that hasn't been the case with all of the physics teachers I've had, most of them, but not all of them. And so he also really cemented in me that grounding of, hey, yes, you can learn physics, and this is how we've done it. And some of the, I guess you could call them accommodations, but more some of the systems that we use to convey information, I still use today. It's just a lot easier and simpler. And so he was just really willing to take me under his wing and show me, just instill in me that, yes, this is how the universe works, and yes, you can learn about it, and yes, you can predict the future with math, which is really, really cool. And so that's partly how I wanted to be a physics major with concentrations in astronomy, because astronomy isn't the science that it really used to be in the 1600s, 1700s. You know, no one looks through telescopes anymore. Optically, it's all done by computers or at different wavelengths, which are still done by computers. So you really need a good, strong background. You know, everyone says don't major in astronomy per se. You can if you want to, but major in physics. And a lot of astronomy programs are basically physics programs with a few astronomy courses thrown in. So major in physics and get a good foundation of how the world works, and then just apply it to the universe, which is what I really think is amazing about astrophysics. You know, the first astrophysics course that I took here at Tech a few years ago was taught by another awesome professor. But that just showed me that, you know, yeah, you can take the things that you've learned in basic sort of college freshman level physics and apply them to the universe, and then cool things start to happen. And you can predict what some of those really cool things are. I mean, obviously in a professional research career, things are definitely more complicated, but that's always sort of how you start out.
As a student, you have had to employ different methods of really kind of understanding a lot of these sometimes more visual concepts. And you gave a really excellent tech talk about this. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that and kind of how that came about, and a little bit about, you know, why it's necessary and what methods you are employing to study some of these more visual concepts in a non-visual way.
The TED Talk actually came a little bit later. It was more the presentation of a almost research project, you might want to say. So let me back up a little bit. In sophomore year of my career here at Virginia Tech, I was required to take a multivariable calculus course, which is basically Calculus 3. It's sort of the next step up from fundamental calculus.
Just hearing the name of it almost gives me a heart attack.
Makes me want to cry.
Yeah, it's okay. My parents stopped helping me with math homework in like sixth grade. The first week of multivariable calculus, we had to learn all these crazy shapes that were used to describe mathematical equations and symbols. If you think about in geometry, how you have a cube and a sphere and a cylinder, and those are kind of the foundation shapes that you use to do all of the geometrical things with. So the crazy three-dimensional shapes were kind of the same thing in multivariable calculus. Everything built upon them. And so my teacher and I really tried and worked together to come up with ways of describing the shapes, but it just wasn't working. I'm a tactile learner, but I'm also one of those people who, when I see a cube on a piece of paper, it's like, wait, it's a square. I don't get it. I'm confused.
Chelsea, would that confusion be because you're trying to imagine a three-dimensional object on a piece of paper?
I think so. I think it's just, I can think in two dimensions and I can think in three dimensions separately, but when you try and smoosh them together, it doesn't always work very well for me.
Understandably.
Yeah, I've heard other blind people say that as well, that it's really hard to even figure out how a sighted person can look at a drawing of a cube and realize it's a cube because it's...
It's just a square. Yeah,
exactly. And so I had those drawings in my calculus book of shapes that were inherently not cubes. And so I got really confused. Well, there was a student from the computer science department who was actually in my class, and he said, would 3D models of these shapes help? And I'm like, yeah, but you're just a student. What are you going to do about it? And actually, he knew someone who knew people in the mechanical engineering lab, and they were able to replicate the shapes using three-dimensional printing, which was just awesome because then I could hold shapes and actually have models. And, you know, on the test, my teacher would look at something and she'd go, okay, what is the equation for this shape? And she would hand me the model and I would be able to recognize it. And later when we did certain types of integrals, I would be able to think about the problem in my head versus trying to keep the shape together all in my head. So it worked out really, really well. And that was more what the TED Talk was about. Someone suggested that I try and present one on that concept. And then it just sort of broadened out into a more general interface concept. So like I was saying earlier with the telescopes and the computers, you know, a lot of people inherently assume that astronomy is a visual science just because of the tradition that it implies, when really it's not anymore. I mean, yes, the computers spit back visual images, but that's only because that's what we've told them to do. You know, to them, it's just a collection of zeros and ones and pixels in various places. And so I think my next challenge is to sort of figure out the right tools and the right interface for me to get at that data and really understand it efficiently.
Where are you at in that process? How much of that data that the computer is spitting back from the telescopes, how much of it can you access at this point?
Most of them are text files, so I can access quite a lot of the raw data. My main challenge in courses has been that, yeah, I can access the raw data, but I really can't interpret it without computer programming, because the first thing that everyone else does is they go and they plot a graph in Excel and then they start playing with the data graphically. And when you have, you know, 100 by 100 grid, you can't do that in a spreadsheet program. And so I think the main challenge that I've had with programming per se is that I've never had good exposure to it. You know, I've always had these professors who are like, well, we use this and this is what we use and this is what you need to code in. And I'm sitting there going, no. So I know a lot of blind programmers and I just need to pick their brains about how they get started. I think it's really just up to me at this point and up to the computers and computer programming that I'm hopefully going to acquire to be really smart about how I interpret the data and what I've pulled out of it. There have been a couple of projects where data has been sonified. So you use sound instead of lines on a page to draw conclusions about what the data is doing. Personally, I've never been able to figure it out. Maybe it's just I haven't sat down and played with some of the beta software that much, but it hasn't really made sense to me as far as an interpreting thing. I mean, there's only so much you can do with it as far as pitch and frequency and amplitude. So I don't know. Maybe I'll get more used to it and maybe that method will be effective. But for right now, it's a real challenge.
The great thing about technology is that it's changing every day. So, you know, 6 months down the road, something that could seem like an insurmountable obstacle can sometimes be left over. So definitely, you know, keep at it and don't give up, because there are resources out there in terms of people and in terms of places on the internet where you can learn the programming skills that you would need to tackle some of these hurdles.
Right. iOS for me has just made a huge difference, because I can get that sort of spatial awareness and just know that I'm at this part in the screen and this is what this was saying. Actually, I worked in 2012 at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is an organization that collaborates with NASA, and they do all of the mission operations for the Hubble. So, like, they tell NASA, we want to look at this, point it this way. and then they get all the data and all the science. And the project that I did there was mainly an accessibility one, which was fine. At that point, again, I wasn't really sure of the tools that I needed. But anyway, the project that I did created HTML images and made them accessible on the iOS devices and even on the Mac trackpad. So you would touch somewhere and it would tell you what was under your finger, and then you touch somewhere else and it would tell you a different region. And interestingly enough, they just released an iBook that has some of those images in there that I worked on, and a whole bunch more stuff that they added and made it really cool. So, I mean, really, I think iOS is sort of the future as far as data representation is concerned. I mean, one of the things that I've wanted to do for a long time is build an app that makes matrix computation easier. So something like the game 2048, where you have different grids and different elements, and you just say, okay, there's this row, there's this column, put them together kind of thing. Because, yeah, computer algebra systems can do it if you know the command line, and if some of them have command line interfaces, which some of them do, some of them don't. But it's just the problem with me is, again, that sort of spatial awareness. So I need something that is as versatile as, say, Braille would be, because Allison, we should talk about this. I love Braille. And I think more people need to learn Nemeth. Grr. But anyway, you know, with the Braille display technology right now, it's only one line. And so when you're doing even a 3x3 matrix that has a whole bunch of crazy elements in it that aren't just one character, it can get really confusing. And so you have to hold the numbers in your head, but then you also have to hold where those numbers are. And just using something like an iOS device to say, okay, put this matrix here, put that matrix there, and then let me play with them and move my finger in the direction that I want them to move, I think that would be really useful. Do I think that's a very hard thing to code? Yes. Do I have the programming skills to do it? No way. Not yet. But, I mean...
But you may develop them, or somebody has them.
Yeah, you can learn
them.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's just the thing, I think, is technology is just crazy and awesome and changing. You know, I had to learn a lot of it myself because a lot of the features that I wanted to learn, the vision teachers didn't know too much about, or they just knew the sort of bare bones basics way of doing things. And so I got very used to teaching myself how to use computers.
Do you think that the larger iPad screen lends itself to perhaps doing some more of the spatial kind of mapping that you're talking about? Would that be an advantage in that sense?
I think so. I have a larger iPad right now. It's a 2. I want to get the mini just because of the form factor, but I don't know if the mini would be too small to do some of that more spatial awareness stuff. It might be more difficult, but I don't know. It's probably not impossible on the iPad mini. So that's even a question that I'm trying to figure out as I'm looking at upgrading.
I think the mini would probably accomplish most of what you want. For me, as a person with smaller hands, I'm finding that the mini is a good compromise between getting more of that spatial awareness that you get from the larger screen and not having too much space.
That would be, that's what I'm thinking too, because even I have smaller hands as well, and there are times where that iPad screen is just too big.
Yeah, I would definitely consider the mini, because I've only been playing with it now for a couple of weeks and I love it.
Well, I would sort of take the opposite tact. I have the iPad Air, and the reason that I got it is because I wanted to have the experience of the larger space. I knew what things were like crowded onto my iPhone screen, and I would think that things would be just a bit less crowded on the mini screen and significantly less crowded on the iPad Air screen. So, I mean, I guess it just depends on, in part at least, what you get used to and what your needs are.
I think that too. And I think also it might depend on even the size of the user interface elements. I mean, I'm finding that even with something like Downcast on the iPad, some of those buttons are really small. You can't hit them and find them as easily as you would like. I don't know if that's been your experience as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how different the interface on many applications is, at least in terms of how it feels to us on the screen. When you talk about the iPhone versus the iPad, it's quite a different experience.
Right, and part of that experience I really like and could be beneficial. I know people hate this, but I really like two-column split way of doing things.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I like it too for web browsing and for email.
Right, and that's the other thing too as far as technology goes. I know we're kind of going on tangents here, but this will happen when you get three geeks together. You know, for years and years and years, I used Windows because that was what was around. You know, JAWS was the only screen reader that I was exposed to, let's say. And so I just kind of got used to it and hated every minute of it. And then I tried the Mac a couple of times and was just extremely frustrated by VoiceOver, really because I wasn't used to it, and mainly because I was on a friend's Mac, you know, I was on another person's Mac and had to give it back within like 5 minutes. So I was sort of pressured in that regard. But then in college, I got the iPhone and wanted to throw it out the window for the first week, but then started to use it and started to really like it. And so I went to one of my other smart Apple friends. I went to visit her over winter break, and she had just gotten a MacBook Air about 6 months before. And by the time I got home, I had cloned her computer and she had shipped it to me. And I haven't really gone back, mainly because for me, the Mac is just so much more intuitive. The interaction model, again, once people get used to it, for me it makes sense. Whether it's because I'm a scientist and I think logically and I categorize things, or whether it's because I can use the trackpad in the same way that I do with iOS, or whether it's because I can install the operating system, or just like do awesome Unix things under the hood if I need to. I don't know. But I find the Mac to be extremely intuitive, and, you know, confession time, when I was in school and learning how to use computers, I always was very mystified by this toolbar concept, and it was just a word to me. It didn't have any significance. I was in it, I was out of it, whatever. But then when I got on the Mac and VoiceOver said toolbar, and I go, oh, what's in here? So I interact with it, and I'm like, oh, it's a little bar area of the screen with tools in it. This mm-hmm. makes sense now. And so I really think that, you know, learning the way that VoiceOver works has made me a more computer literate person, because I can usually understand now what sighted people are talking about. Interestingly enough, I'm not really sure of a lot of the sighted Mac commands, so I have a little bit of trouble there when I'm communicating with people. But it just seems to me to be a bit more fluid. And that's sort of my Apple convert story. I still use Windows for some things. I actually have Windows on this machine. I don't know how much longer that's going to be, but you know, if there are a couple of Excel functions that I really need that Numbers either can't do or can't do as well, or there's a game on Windows where you can fly a simulated fighter jet, so of course I would like that one. But, you know, overall, the Mac for me is just extremely way more intuitive, and I really like how most of the applications perform on it. I mean, Apple's commitment to accessibility has been discussed many, many times on this podcast, so I won't go too deep into it. But, I mean, it's just great that, you know, I can take my phone and have it identify money and read me email and tell me, you know, when a flight's about to leave. I mean, it's just wonderful.
That's one of the best explanations I've ever heard of how there are some real advantages to using the Mac and using iOS. And it's fascinating.
Really? Wait a minute. Back up. Really?
I think so. I mean,
you did great. You did awesome.
Yeah, you were very clear in explaining it and had good reasoning behind it.
Did I sound too fanboyish?
Not at all. You sounded very logical, very scientific, actually, in your
Besides, in your it's not possible to sound too fanboyish for not this here, podcast.
Anyway. For grad school, I might get VR to try and get an iMac because the laptops are great. I still think the desktop has its place, but even the Bluetooth keyboard, you know, I can be at another part of my room. I can be sitting on my bed and have my desktop all the way in the corner and still respond to me. That is awesome. But anyway, you know, that's going to be my next challenge. And I think for me, it's very important. The other thing too, and you can run Windows. I mean, come on, you can run whatever operating system you want. And that's very important for scientists because most people in the physics department, they like Windows. They use it because they have to. People who want to get a little more geeky or really want to do stuff get a Mac. And then people who want to get serious work done go out and they just use Linux. So that might be my next thing, but one of the things that has always confused me, and maybe explain this, I don't know, but everyone says, oh, a Mac isn't as powerful as Windows. And I'm sitting there going, do you not know about this application called Terminal? I mean, you know, I'm learning MATLAB right now for my orbital mechanics course, and I got on the phone with someone the other day to try and set it up. And to open MATLAB on the GUI, you know, you click and you do all these sorts of things. And he's sitting there and he's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to make a link so that you tell the computer MATLAB is here. And then we're going to make an alias command that tells the computer when you type this command, something like a keyboard maestro macro, but you just do it in the terminal. So, for example, when I type ML, it opens MATLAB, and it just does it so quickly. And I can tell it to open MATLAB, run this script file, and then put the output in this text file, and it's one line of code. It's beautiful.
You're exactly right. People don't really understand the power and flexibility of the Mac, and that comes from long years of being inundated with the message that Windows is the way to go if you're serious about computing, and nothing could be further from the truth as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Allison, what has been your experience? I mean, you work in vocational rehab. I'm not dissing your profession by any means.
I buy Macs for people when they when it's at all a feasible solution, because I really think that it's a great operating system. It's a great ecosystem in which to dwell computer-wise.
With iOS and Yosemite, I mean, my workflows are going to get so much faster.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Tell me about it. I used Windows like you for a lot of years. Was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into the Mac world. I had really loved iOS since about 2010, and that was great. But when Robert and I started podcasting together, he's like, you know, it would really be a lot easier if you did this on the Mac. And I had a Mac, and I kept kind of using it and going away from it and using it and going away from it. And I'm like, all right, fine. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a month, and I'm going to just turn Windows off completely, and I'm going to use Mac to accomplish everything that I want to do and see how I do. Within about 2 weeks, I was completely hooked. Robert.
Nice. I mean, even two things really quick, and then you can ask your next question. But even something as simple as when Apple rewrote Numbers, okay, they made it so that generally VoiceOver reads column and row headers as you're moving through the table. And so you don't have to remember what columns are in what cell. And that is just amazing to me as a physicist, because that was one of my biggest problems. I loved Excel because everything was in its own little cell and contained and whatnot, but I hated it when my data tables got like 26 columns wide and depended on each other because I needed to just, you know, I needed to refer back to columns. And being in a spreadsheet program, you can only access one cell at a time. The other little thing that I love is that when you're typing in a formula, if you go in and do it, let's just say you're doing 2A1, I don't know. So you type in 2, you type in the star, you type in A1, and then what VoiceOver will read back to you is it'll read back 2 times A2 cell. And so you know that that A2, or whichever cell you're using, is a, not a number, but is a part of that cell. Now, I don't know if JAWS 15 or 16 is going to do that, but, I mean, it's just really great to think about the little things. Like, yes, that's an argument, that's an entity. I don't have to remember what that number goes to.
The cool thing about the Mac is it does a lot of the same things that Windows can do with the various screen readers without all of the fooling around that you have to do in general to get Windows to do. And the problem with Windows is you would fool around to get it to do what you wanted it to do, and then half the time it wouldn't work anyway. So
yeah, then it would update and break something, and you have to, you know, oh, great, I have to wait for the next version of the screen reader to come out. Now, are there bugs? Yes. Are there bugs in numbers that I want Apple to fix? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's any operating system. You know, my mom, she used to work in the punch card days, and she would always find the one in a million bugs that were completely rare and no one else would find. Over the years, I think I've inherited that from her, unfortunately. And the other thing really quick that I want to say about the Mac is when I was very, very little, I think we had a government grant or insurance or something for getting a computer. And at that time, Macs were always in the schools. This was in the mid-90s. And so we got one, and I enjoyed, you know, playing little computer games on it with some of the vision that I had. You know, I could just blow up the screen or whatever. You know, I was a little kid, so I didn't really care. But to me, that whole Mac boot up startup time associated with, you know, ooh, this is a computer, and now good things are about to happen. And so to kind of come full circle is just really great for me in general.
Yeah, because good things are happening.
And yes.
You're able to take part in that. We all are fully participate in that thanks to Apple's commitment to accessibility and their willingness to go the extra mile to sweat the details.
Right. And really, that's what science is about, too. It's about just, you know, yeah, if the details aren't right, something's going to go wrong. Something's going to crash. You know, I learned that very early in my aviation days. And so when people come up to me now and say, oh, you know, it's only off by this much, who cares? I'm sitting there and I'm going, who cares? What do you mean, who cares? That's important. But I've always been a very detail-oriented person. Now, of course, in astronomy, you know, orders of magnitude take on a little bit of a different flavor. It's like, it's between 1 and 100. Pi is 1, we're all good. But even there, too, you know, detail is extremely important.
Absolutely. So I wonder something, Chelsea, and it's really clear from everything that you've said that your enthusiasm, your intelligence, your passion obviously will take you a long way. And I don't think there's any limit to what you can accomplish because you know how to advocate for yourself. You know how to get help from people who know the things that you need to learn about. And so it's really fun and really exciting to hear about it. But I also am aware that in this world, you know, you are sort of in a position of being a minority on two counts, being a woman and being someone who is blind. And so is there much of a flip side for you on this? Have you had a hard time because of being female, because of being visually impaired. What is the downside?
I think the downside is still perception. I have found that my blindness, more than my being a woman, has contributed to people sort of writing me off or not believing what I can do or, to some extent, not even giving me an opportunity. Interestingly enough, some of the professors and administrators and teachers over the years that I've had a hard time working with have been women. Why that is the case, I have no idea. But I think it's still the blindness and the perception. I am lucky at my university to, you know, the people who are here now, to be surrounded by people who completely or mostly completely get it. You know, freshman year, before I even came to Virginia Tech, I sat in the astronomy professor's office and I said, look, I want to get an astronomy minor. And he's like, okay. And he pulls out the minor check sheet and he's like, well, you're going to have to take this course and this course and this course. And this won't be a problem for you because we can have someone work with you. And this won't be a problem for you because you can already use a computer. And he just did that for every single course. So that's been helpful. Has everything worked out great? No. Has everything been, you know, completely easy? No, of course not. And I think that that's the real challenge. You know, even in the scientific and astronomical communities, that sense of disability, of lowering expectations or just the, you know, the general societal stereotypes that we're all familiar with are still there. I mean, this is an engineering college primarily, and I still get people who, you know, when I ask where's the trash can in the dining hall, they moved it again. They'll go, over there. And I'm like, you're an engineer? You should think about this for a minute? And then there'll be some people who will go, you know, oh, just go, you know, 4 feet and then 45 degrees. And I'll be like, yes, thank you. But I really think, and I think this is starting to come out, but I really think that as blind people, we have special qualities that if we can get through the craziness and sometimes horror of, you know, a public school or a blind school education, if we can get through that with our scientific curiosity intact, then there won't be too much that can stop us. And also, you know, I think that people are realizing that we have gifts and advantages that other people might not. You know, I've always been told that I might think about physics a little bit differently because I have to imagine most things or use three-dimensional objects to represent things or, you know, what have you, just the way I work with the material. And that might help me scientifically. Is it going to stop me from, you know, getting the best scientific education possible or doing research or whatever? No. Am I going to lean on it like, you know, oh, well, I'm blind, so I have to be the greatest physicist ever? No, that's definitely not where I'm going. But I also think that we need to be recognized as scientists. And then if we do accessibility work for a career, fine. But then if we also do legitimate, awesome scientific work for a career with accessibility just thrown in there because that's how we have to interface with the world, then that's great too.
One thing that really strikes me about what you're saying is a common theme on this podcast. Almost everyone we talk to seems to exude this idea. So I think there's really something to it, is that somehow to be successful at doing what you're trying to do, you can't allow the frustrations, the no's, the misunderstandings, the stereotypes, if you will, to bring you down, to stop you from moving forward. And that's just, I think, honestly, maybe the biggest challenge that we as people who are blind face is we have to somehow be a bit bulletproof when it comes mm-hmm. to letting some of that stuff bounce off of us and not slow us down. Because if we're not careful, I think as people who are blind, probably almost certainly as women, you know, is another piece of it. We are bombarded constantly with no's or stereotypes.
Yeah, I agree completely. Even something as simple as a college dining hall. You know, I'm not saying that I don't have the travel skills or can't, you know, accomplish it or whatever. But even something as simple as that, you know, it's like, if I'm eating actually in the dining hall, I have to pick a very strategic table so that I can find my way back if I go to get a drink refill or something like that. And, you know, I'm not, I totally agree with you. I mean, it's hard. I'm not going to lie. And as a scientist, it's going to be doubly hard. And that can definitely get to you sometimes. You caught me in a good mood today. But, you know, I think that's worth surrounding yourself with really good people and even people who you can talk to and rant at. And, you know, I've had a lot of scientific mentors over the years. Carrie Schiappolo was the main one, who has gone there before and worked hard and gotten his PhD. So it's like, yes, there is hope. I do want to be the first one, but there have people who have been coming before me. And as a physicist, it's actually really hard because I don't know of anyone who reads Braille who has gotten their physics degree in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. Now, people can certainly send me email and say, oh, I did that. I'm here. Fine. I definitely welcome that. But, you know, physics is a tricky scientific field and it's a tricky one to get into. And I think also that has to do with the technology. I mean, you have in freshman classes now, you have this online homework stuff that is completely, for the most part, just either inaccessible or ridiculously hard to use. I still had to deal with it. It was frustrating, but I knew that once I got to the upper level classes, you know, it would go away. One of my biggest problems, I took event placement physics in high school, and we had to do virtual labs. Because the school didn't have enough equipment to do actual physical labs. So we would do Java-type things on the computer. And even though Newport News was a very military-rich, there were a lot of colleges in the area kind of place, it was almost impossible for me to do because I couldn't find anyone who either had the time or had the knowledge of even the language of physics to explain what would happen. And if I had taken that class before the awesome class in aviation, I would not be a physics major. I got really discouraged, but I figured out a way to sort of pull out of it and just realize that everything would work out. You know, there's always been that point in the semester where everything just seems kind of hopeless for a while, and then you come out of it and you realize that everything will work out. Again, I've had help and I've had people to talk to and I've had people to bounce ideas off of, but it has been very tricky. So technology is definitely a double-edged sword, and I think that's where the creativity part can come in. You know, I love it in the Steve Jobs biography where they all said he was standing at the intersection of technology and arts, because for me, some of the writing that I've done and just other things, that's helped too, has sort of to just have a sort of creative reading, writing type of outlet, because I really think that the whole piece of computers just has to come together. You know, they talk about a fighter pilot, how he sort of, or she, sort of melds with the machine, becomes, you know, part of the airplane. And that, I think, is what humans and computers need to do to get this kind of work done that we want to get done.
Well, I think you made a really important point when you were talking about how creativity seems to be a way that you are able to recharge your battery, revitalize yourself in some ways, because it is stressful being a college student. It's even stressful getting everything taken care of in the dining hall, as you said, as a person who's blind, and not other people on your campus who are sighted have that stressful experience of the dining hall. They can just look and see where they need to go to the trash can or where they need to go to refill their drink or whatever. But the point is, it seems like you have to have some really good mechanism for recharging your battery, for balancing that stressful time out and having a chance to recover from that. And it seems like in one respect, creativity is one of the ways that you found to do that. And it's fun to hear about that.
One of the things that me and a couple other physics major friends would do was we would get together and go to someone's room or do it online if it was the weekend, and we go and watch the Big Bang Theory.
Oh, there you go.
and so sometimes I'd be like, yeah, that's my social life is watching the Big Bang Theory every week, because you definitely need some sort of a break. And even myself, I have trouble taking breaks. You know, I'm the kind of person who can just sit there and work a problem for, I don't know, 3-4 hours until I get it done.
We have to take that kind of determination and that kind of will to pursue what you're working on. And so you're well suited for that kind of environment. And that's really where exciting things happen. We don't think too much about it, but it's those people who sit there and work those problems for hours who have given us things like Apple devices.
Right, exactly.
And that's all kind of done in the background. It's not what we think about necessarily when we open the, you know, the box and get the shiny new thing out, like we're going to soon be doing here with some new products. But I
can't wait. I'm excited. If something crazy and weird happens, and I'm pretty sure I will, I'm applying right now. But if something strange happens and I don't get into grad school right away, you know, the only really one, a couple of places I'd want to work, one of them would definitely be Apple, because I like that challenge. I like that spirit of just determination and wanting to get it right and paying attention to the details. You know, I keep a couple quotes around, and one of my favorite ones that's helped me get through a lot is by Ronald Reagan. He was addressing, it was the speech he gave right after the Challenger explosion. And interestingly enough, my father saw that launch. I was hoping he would get to see another one before before he saw one of mine, so we'll see how that goes. But anyway, Ronald Reagan, he said, you know, he was referring to the crew, and he said of them, they had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, give me a challenge and I'll meet it with joy. And that helps me a lot.
Yeah, it's a great quote, and it really is right on target with what you're pursuing. And it's so much fun to hear about that. I know that this is just the beginning for you in some ways. There's likely to be graduate school and a career and things to come along. And so I'm just hoping that maybe from time to time you'll come back on this podcast and update us on where you're at and what's going on, because there's bound to be exciting things happening for you.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back.
Oh, thank you. I would love to come back. I mean, in high school, I was really at odds with myself because you had that polarization of you're only good at science or you're only good at English or art or whatever it has to be. And then in college, through listening to podcasts and all your awesome guests and, you know, being able to take courses in things that I was actually interested in, I was able to find out that, yes, I can be good at science and something creative. And that just really makes me who I am and feel very complete inside.
You bet. And as we kind of bring this to a close, Chelsea, is there anything that you would like to leave people with as far as contact information or anything that you would like the Tech Doctor listeners to know about as we come to a close here?
Sure. Unfortunately, I don't have too much of an internet presence except for articles and that kind of thing. But if anyone is wanting to contact me about some of the ideas or even students who are just trying to get started, they can certainly try my school email address, which should stay around for a long time. And that is my last name, Cook, C-O-O-K, 2010 at vtvirginiatech.edu.
Excellent. And are you related to Tim?
No, I don't think so. I wish sometimes. I wish.
Well, you got a pretty good last name for an Apple present, so not bad. Thank you, Chelsea, very much for being here and taking your time to record with us. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure and look forward to hearing more about what you do in the future.
And if our listeners would like to get a hold of Robert and I via email, they can do so by sending an email to techdoctor@dr-carter.com.
Good job of spitting that out. And this is Robert the Tech Doctor. For this time, I will say so long, and everybody take care.
And this is Allison Hartley signing off as usual with bye, everyone.